with what the state of Israel is doing in the Middle East, what does it mean today to be a Jew in America? I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
In the new and dreadful context of the State of Israel's indiscriminate carpet bombing of Gaza, which has killed some 30,000, mainly women and children, what does it mean to be a Jew? I am Jewish, and many people expect me to support the Israeli state in its current war. To that expectation, I pointedly differentiate the people Israel, the worldwide diaspora of Jewish people, of which I am a proud part, and the militarized, nationalistic, racist state, which calls itself Israel. That is not the people Israel. The state of Israel and its supporters intentionally conflate Judaism with Zionism, and the result has been a ratcheting up of anti-Semitism as millions across the globe are furious as to what that state is doing in Gaza and the West Bank. And if they imagine all Jews stand with Israel, ouch, that hurts. So what does it mean to be a Jewish American in the 2020s? As has been said, if you get four Jews together, you have five differing opinions. There are Orthodox Jews, Naturae Carta, which vehemently opposes that state calling itself Israel. That ultra-Orthodox group considers the state of Israel to be illegitimate. But there are also conservative Jews, Reform Jews, Hasidic Jews, Talmudic Jews, Chabad Jews, and Reconstructionist Jews, and probably other sects with which I am not familiar. We're Jews, after all. Without question, there's a great variety of Judaism, and with it, attitudes toward the Israeli state. Some of my Jewish friends have taken issue with me for criticizing the intensely violent and racist actions of the Netanyahu government. I have been called a self-hating Jew because of this. Writing on Tom Dispatch, our guest Robert Litzeit asks, what kind of Jew am I? Robert Litzeit is a longtime sports reporter and columnist for the New York Times and the author of more than 20 books. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Commentary in 1992 and won Columbia University's Meyer Burger Award for Distinguished Reporting in 1966 and 1996. He was the ombudsman for ESPN in 2013-2014. His books include the recent memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer, Sports World, and American Dreamland, and Dick Gregory's autobiography, Nigger. Ooh, I hate saying that word. In 2001, he won the Margaret A. Edwards Award from the American Library Association for lifetime contribution to young adult literature. His best-selling teenage novels include The Contender, One Fat Summer, which was made into a film, Measure of a Man, starring Donald Sutherland, whom I greatly appreciate. Lipsyte's television career includes CBS Sunday Morning with Charles Kuralt, NBC Nightly News, and a weekly PBS show. Lipsyte has taught journalism and creative nonfiction at Farley Dickinson and New York universities, and lectured at many colleges, including Columbia, Yale, Princeton, Boston University, and others. And he recently lectured on sports during an Atlantic crossing of the Queen Mary II. That's quite a curriculum vitae. Thanks for being with us, Robert.
Thank you, Bert. And I have to say that I was a Jew for all that stuff, and still not sure what it means. But, I mean, you're right. I mean, I think a lot of us right now are taking some sort of internal reevaluation of, you know, who are we and why are we getting all this shit from other Jews because, one, we're not supporting Israel hard enough, or, two, we're not supporting the Palestinians hard enough. I mean, I've gotten calls and letters from Jews after I wrote the piece who said, don't you understand, Hamas are freedom fighters. You should equate them with the guys who fought their way out of the Warsaw Ghetto.
Wow.
Yeah, make that comparison.
There's a huge variety of opinion, for sure. But that sort of comes with the territory. And you begin your essay in Tom Dispatch with this. And I think this is interesting to delve into. Quote, long ago, I came to believe that being a Jew, even a secular one like me, entailed certain responsibilities, end of quote. What are those responsibilities? In what ways does being a Jew entail those responsibilities? Talk about that.
Well,
please.
You know, I mean, I've been through rethinking that a lot. I mean, that in some ways, that really sounds like bullshit, even to me, who's saying it, because that really evokes the idea of Jewish exceptionalism, that we are special, that we are different, that, you know, God or whoever has singled us out for special perks and also for special responsibilities. But somehow it seems to me that a people who've gone through so much hell, so much suffering, all these centuries, really have almost an obligation to be on the right side of things. And the, you know, it's not always so hard to come up with the right side of things. And it seems to me that when you are persecuting another people in a land that you're sharing, you're not on the right side of things. So simple enough. I remember the first time, the only time I went to Israel, it kind of knocked me out because, you know, I thought the settlers, you know, they kind of lived, you know, with John Wayne in adobe shacks or something on the plains. I didn't realize that settlers were living in beautiful high-rise apartment buildings.
Right.
And that, of course, you know, the Palestinian quarters were not on the same level.
No, for sure. So, and you refer to the often used phrase that I've heard as well, "people of the book," like a claim to being a smarter species. I've always bristled at the term "the chosen people." It sounds way too much like a master race. How do you handle that phrase, either "people of the book" or "chosen people"?
Oh, I hate them both. I mean, you know, what book? The last one I wrote? That would be good. Right. No, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, and you know, it's kind of the idea that, you know, that we are, you know, smarter and special. And it didn't go anywhere for me. You know, I grew up so Jewish I didn't have to be Jewish. I grew up in Queens, in New York City, in a overwhelmingly Jewish neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, middle class, lower middle class. My parents were city school teachers, and you didn't have to think about being Jewish,
right?
Because that was the water that we were swimming in. I mean, I didn't really think about that until some Catholic kids that I played with every summer upstate New York, you know, around, I guess it was around the sixth grade, they said, sorry, Bob, we can't play with you anymore because you killed Christ. You know, right. I was just kind of dumbfounded. I was a kid. I mean, now I think, you know, yeah, if you don't wash your ass, I'll kill you too. But I mean, whoever comes up with, you know, the right things to say in moments like that. But it was terrible. And obviously it was their parents who had told them. I mean, the best joke that I heard in all of this was, you know, question. What is anti-Semitism? Answer, hating Jews more than is necessary. Okay, Bert, you're a smart guy. What does that mean? It sounds wonderful.
Oh, man, I had never heard that before. And I'll tell you what.
Neither had I, yeah.
Wow. I where I grew up, if you had told me that Jews were a minority in the world, I would have thought you were crazy. I mean, everybody in my suburb of Boston growing up in the 50s was pretty much from, you know, second generation immigrants, either Jewish or Catholic, one or the other. Mm-hmm. And I was raised a Reformed Jew. My father's parents kept a kosher home. My grandfather, little secret here, my grandfather would come to our house on occasional Sundays to have bacon with us heathens. How were you raised? What kind of Jewishness was it? Reform, conservative, Orthodox? What was it? Or none of the above?
Yeah, I mean, we were kind of lox and bagel Jews. I mean, that was kind of really the extent of what we worshipped. My father famously said, Judaism would be a really great religion if you could get God out of it.
Right.
And I've always thought he was absolutely right. There were a lot of positive things, particularly in, I fell into Reform Judaism just before I turned 13.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and that was the beginning of my Jewish education. I had no Jewish education. We didn't deal with it. There was no pressure to be Jewish. And all I remember was that there was a period where I was delivering for a local pharmacy, and the worst tipper was the local rabbi. And that was that formed some of my opinion. But when I was 12 and a half, my grandparents, who had retired and gone to Florida, came back and were appalled that I wasn't being bar mitzvahed.
Mm-hmm.
And they insisted, that 6 months, where do you get a quickie bar mitzvah? somewhere in the depths of Queens, they find this little Reform temple, which, as I wrote, were either poor enough or progressive enough, for money to perform a quickie bar mitzvah. Well, it turns out the rabbi, a man named Solomon Landman, who had been run out of, I think it was Cincinnati or Cleveland, for being too much of a civil rights activist,
yeah,
was just a wonderful man. And so, after 6 months of, just learning enough so that I could give a speech about what hypocrites you guys in the audience were for not being better Jews, he enrolled me, insisted that I come to his confirmation classes.
Uh-huh.
And this was a kind of a course in just what we're talking about, what I felt were the obligations of being Jewish and the achievements, the true achievements, from Albert Einstein to Sandy Koufax,
mm-hmm,
to my particular hero, Dr. Goldberger, who was the guy who discovered that, niacin was the missing element in pellagra, and, he created what became vitamin B3. I thought it should have been vitamin G for Goldberger. But so it was a kind of a wonderful eye-opening experience to, what was really good about Jews. Jews did achieve. They were good guys. They, felt this obligation as Dr. Landman, the rabbi, did, until when I hit 14, he dropped dead.
Yeah.
And at that moment, of course, my reaction was, you, God,
oops,
either you don't exist or you're not paying attention to me. And that was the end of, that was the end of it for me. And I did not get back into it until, 25 maybe years later. I was I was being treated for cancer at the Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, and the Jewish chaplain of the hospital walked in to offer me. He asked if I wanted to pray with him. I threw him out. I said, where was your God when I got sick? I don't need him now. I need, the doctor now. And I wrote about it. And in writing about it, I got a letter from a guy who had been a college classmate of mine, although we did not know each other, wonderful rabbi named Alvin Cass, who is now the head chaplain for the police department. And he said, I think that, you have to kind of slow down and reevaluate, all your angers, you can't let the people who hate Jews define your Judaism. You have to think through what might be the treasures of Judaism that you might like to pluck. Would you like to talk? And of course, we started talking, and we've become very close friends over the last 25 years.
Nice. Yeah, I also, we do have some similarities. I had a bar mitzvah, and I stayed in religious school for the confirmation class. I had not really enjoyed religious school. In fact, there were times me and a friend, we'd sneak out and go down and get some, go to a nearby Jewish deli. But I did go to confirmation class, and that one, that was really valuable, looking at what it means to be Jewish, some of the philosophy and experience. It was a very positive experience. And I know I carry a lot of that with me today. And it's hard sometimes because, people get this image of Judaism, but they don't really know, it's the background of Christianity, certainly. It's the basis of it. There is a lot of value in being Jewish, I still believe. And if you just tuned in, dear listener, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Robert Lipsight, who is a Tom Dispatch regular and a former sports and city columnist for the New York Times. He's the author, among other works, of Sports World and American Dreamland. And we're talking about what it means to be Jewish in the mid-2020s. And
go ahead. Bert, did you become an observant Jew after your bar mitzvah and confirmation?
No more observant than I had before, which it means to say not really at all, quite frankly. I'm a bagels and lux kind of Jew, I guess. Which defines, I think, most of us in America. I know there are, people who are much more observant than I am, but I suppose it's like a cafeteria, you pick and choose in there, right? Stuff like
that. Do you think there are any advantages to being Jewish in America?
Wow, that is a good question. Advantages? Well, in that we treasure books. We treasure learning. That's one of the values that has been there as being part of the Jewish tradition, that you really value books. Books are something you don't throw books away. Books are important. So that much, yeah, I do. And I think, valuing education for its own sake and trying to understand and to care about other people and to care about justice. I mean, the civil rights movement. A lot of Jews were involved with the civil rights movement.
Right.
So I think that's a big part of who we are. A very large percentage of the white supporters and participants were Jewish. I wonder, have we had what you might consider a historical obligation to Black Americans?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's exactly what, when we started talking about, this idea of exceptionalism.
Oh, yes.
The idea that we're God's chosen people, that's bullshit.
Yes.
But the idea that we do, even if it's self-imposed, we do have some kind of obligation that we take some sort of pride in. Sure, the Jewish contribution to the civil rights movement was enormous.
Yes, no question about it. And it's interesting how people on the right have sort of secretly held to a belief that Jews are commies. You look at the Rosenbergs, for example. The Jews were internationalists and not necessarily the same thing as nationalists. And I'm certainly not a nationalist. I think that's caused tremendous damage and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of deaths through the years of nationalism. And so, but Jews tend to be occasionally, if you look at stereotypes, suspect of being, are we really patriotic? I think so. I consider myself highly patriotic. My opposition to the war in Vietnam was based on patriotism to what this country was about, fighting off colonialism and supporting people struggling for self-definition and being able to dictate their own future. So, yeah, there are a lot of values, I think, to being Jewish, for sure.
And I kind of internalize a lot of things. I mean, you know, I hate a Dershowitz.
Yes.
I hate a Kissinger.
Yes.
I hate, you know, the emergence, you know, these bad Jews, you know, with, you know, bad values. I remember I was covering the murders in New York when David Berkowitz,
uh-huh.
you know, was captured as the son of Sam Tiller.
Right.
And the idea, oh, God, not Berkowitz. And, you know, luckily it turned out that he had been adopted. And so that all kind of floated away because it really wasn't clear whether he was Jewish or Italian or who really his father and mother had been. You kind of do sort of take those things, you know, seriously. Oh, actually, and I remember once at covering a World Series in the locker room, after the final game,
lucky you.
The pitcher had been Jim Palmer, and he excused himself to take a phone call, and we were told that he was getting a phone call from his mother, and I forget her name, but it was something like, you know, Sadie Rappaport. I said, "Oh my God!
Yeah,
you know, could Jim Palmer, you know, really be Jewish?" But then it turned out that no, that was some sort of married name, and no, he was not Jewish. But you know, I also felt, yeah, I have to get over that. That's kind of silly, but you know, that kind of little bit flush of pride. Sandy Koufax,
yeah,
you know, the sports, you know, hero of our youth,
absolutely.
It was very nice when I became a sports writer and became, you know, met some of these people. But he was a very nice, smart guy. You know, wow. It would have been terrible if he was, you know, a jerk like Mickey Mantle, who was not Jewish.
No.
You know?
No,
it was not, as we said, Mickey Mandel.
Oh man, it's Sandy Koufax was kind of a hero at one of our local Jewish delis, Jack and Marion's, over on Harvard Street in Brookline. There was a painting on the wall, and it had Sandy Koufax was on there. I believe, now you're a sports writer, you would be able to clarify this.
Sure.
Did he actually miss a World Series game because it was a high holiday?
Yeah.
I thought so. I wasn't sure about that. That was very impressive to us.
It was
kids.
Yom Kippur.
Well, yeah, you can't do that on Yom Kippur.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't the only one. I mean, I think that there was a tipping point of Jewish sports writers by the time Sandy Koufax came along. So he got a lot of good press. But in many ways, because of the time, a more courageous Jewish athlete was Hank Greenberg.
Uh-huh.
Who also didn't play on, you know, holy days, and was observant, and was was a good guy, but I think that he had to be a little lower profile.
Well, getting back to what is most unfortunate, the horrible, horrible war that's going on right now between the Israeli state, and I have a hard time calling it Israel because Israel, to me, always meant the people Israel, those of us who are spread across the world. That's
diaspora,
The diaspora. But anyway, there's the Israeli state, and October 7th happened, and the Israeli state went on to commit what I consider to be war crimes in intense retaliation. You say in your essay, quote, "I've never thought so hard or helplessly about anything as I have recently about what it means to be a Jew." Why did you feel that way?
Oh, well, I mean, as you point out, we got jocular too fast, but you're right. I mean, the horror of the retaliation, it was beyond eye for an eye. I mean, remember eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth?
Mm.
It was way beyond that. It was kind of hideous. I think part of the problem is it's really very hard for people to hold, you know, two separate things in their hands at the same time. You know, Hamas I believe Hamas were vandals and thugs.
Yes.
I don't believe that. Yeah. On the other hand, of course, there was an aspect of being freedom fighters who were, you know, standing up for their persecuted people. On the other hand, Netanyahu's militarized government were vandals and thugs. But yet, you have to understand that after so many centuries of being kicked out of every country in the world, it seems, Jews really do need a safe place. Now, I don't think this is the way to make it safe and keep it safe. But in any hand, I think that, you know, we have to weigh, you know, not who's better, who's worse, but we have to weigh the idea that this is a nuanced situation. Probably not as complex as you know, Netanyahu's government wants you to think it is, because if it's really complex, then we can say, well, it's insoluble. There's nothing we can do about it. But of course there are things we can do about it. I have to tell you about this, Bert. Could I ramble on for a moment?
No, go please.
Last week I had, you know, an amazing experience. I live on Shelter Island right now, out at the eastern end of Long Island, and I went to Southampton to a Unitarian church where they were staging a discussion between an Orthodox settler rabbi, Jewish, and an activist tour guide Arab. And they were wonderful. They were absolutely wonderful. And what was so amazing about them is what they said. The major takeaway is we've had enough dialogue. We've had enough discussion. What we need to do is sit down and listen. Just listen to each other's stories. And you know, the Jew who had been born in New York and eventually went to Israel, and the Arab who had been born in Jordan and eventually, you know, moved to the West Bank, told their stories, just their stories of growing up, of what life was like, of checkpoints, of schools, of opportunities lost, of persecution. And they didn't talk to each other. They didn't argue with each other. They didn't try to say, oh, mine was worse than yours. They just listened. And everybody in the audience was totally spellbound. And we began, and if you didn't, by then, we began to see these two very disparate people as just human beings, just people. It was like the first, you know, baby step to some sort of understanding and trust who the other guy was, and the possibility that there could be common ground. There could be, and they didn't use the word Holy Land. They called it Whole Land.
Oh, wow. I like that.
With the idea that, you know, there could be some sort of innovative federation where instead of, you know, partitioning off the land, you know, people would but live there in some sort of federated state. It was wonderful. It was an amazing experience for me. I mean, it really, this was after I had written my piece. And And of course, in writing the piece, I became more interested in the subject and started reading and going around and found this thing. The organization is called Roots, and I think that they're trying to do this all over America.
Interesting. And I do find the common thread that I think links together the people who are, you know, MAGA, the Trump people, is that they feel like they haven't been listened to. Like the right. Democrats, the Hillary Clinton Democrats didn't listen to them. The elitist didn't on Two Coasts didn't listen to them. People need to feel listened to. And I think that's a very, that must have been a fascinating, fascinating discussion.
Yeah, they were just talking about, you know, the situation in Israel.
Sure.
But I think you really just now put the finger on. I mean, that's everything. That's MAGA. That's my wife and me.
Yeah.
I mean, Bob, shut up already. You don't have to solve this problem. I just want you to hear what I'm
yes,
saying.
Yes, that's so important. And it's a hard, hard lesson to learn. It shouldn't be so hard, but it is
right.
a hard lesson to learn. If you just tuned in, dear listener, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're speaking with sports writer extraordinaire Rob Litzite. And he's written an article in Tom Dispatch about wondering what kind of Jew am I? He says he's heartbroken by the war in Israel, as I think we all are. And it's caused a great deal of consternation, of tzuris, if you will, among the Jewish community as to what we are. You started to wonder, as the attack on Gaza continued, you questioned the moral strength of the Israeli, that the Israeli state still had. You cite Samson in the Bible story. Do tell.
Right. I mean, well, he did pull the temple down, and I assume that he killed himself in the process. I think. I mean...
Yeah.
Did I read that right?
I'm not a real expert in that by a long shot, but I believe you're right. And
yeah.
The people saying, you know, that this is the Israeli state defending itself, I'll tell you, I tend to think maybe it's doing a Samson thing, pulling the whole thing down. You know, they haven't won any more friends in the world, that's for sure. And looking at the various backgrounds here, my background and your background, you're a little bit older than I am. Yeah, you're a fair amount older than I am. What did you find was the prevailing Jewish attitude toward Jewish refugees from Germany? And more immediately, what does your experience say about the attitude of many Americans today towards refugees who are risking their lives fleeing truly awful situations? What about that refugee situation that, I mean, we Jews have been refugees all, you know, for many, many years.
Well, yeah, I mean, actually, that was my true first experience with anti-Semitism was Jew against Jew. The neighborhood that I lived in Queens, I think that most of the people were the second generation of immigrants who had come in the 80s from Eastern Europe.
Right.
And so in the 40s, in the late 30s and into the 40s, when the refugees from Hitler came,
right.
And afterwards, you know, the concentration camp survivors, you know, who in many ways were often, particularly the German Jews, better cultured, better educated,
mm-hmm.
and with more financial resources
yes.
within our country. You know, there was family there ahead. And they were, you know, not welcomed with open arms. I mean, they were seen as being, you know, uppity or
right.
arrogant. And also they were going to replace them. Of course, nope. you know, there's almost so much shelf space for Jews. you know what these guys, you know. But, you know, I had a big experience. My first wife's family had come from Germany in 1938. My wife was in her mother's belly on the ship coming over.
Uh-huh.
And her father had been a very well-to-do man in what turned out to be East Germany. So he got no reparations. But, you know, he was a smart man, and he managed to, you know, make a life for his four children in Buffalo, New York. But the thing that really struck me was he had been a corporal in the Kaiser's army.
Yes.
In World War One. In fact, he was very proud of the bullet hole in his thigh. He took one for the Kaiser.
Uh-huh.
And he thought that Hitler might have been on the right track. He thought that Hitler had some very good ideas, particularly, economic ideas. And he also thought that it was those, pushy, dirty, uneducated Eastern European Jews, and I guess the Sephardim as well, who kind of made things hard for everybody else. Otherwise, maybe, Hitler would have gotten off this Jew thing. I mean, I thought it was insane.
Yeah.
And I thought, he was a very nice guy, and there were so many things about him that were so wrong. He was also a slum landlord.
Oh, my.
But he was a stereotypical Jew.
Uh-huh.
But the idea of the complexity of how Jews thought, how Jews fought each other, how, Jews could really not be trusted in so many ways was startling to me. I mean, coming from a place where we all sort of fought the same way in lockstep, pretty much like you and I do right now.
So it seems. And you can imagine how I feel. I don't know if anybody's ever called you a self-hating Jew.
All the time. Oh, yeah. If you don't, if you criticize any aspect of Zionism, Judaism, it's your fault. You're a self-hating Jew.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
That's so horrible, because I am anything but that. I personally, I'm not observant. I mean, I like bagels and lox, and, high holidays, I'll go there. And
right.
But that's just... It's crazy, but I know from my father's experience, there were attitudes towards German Jews as well back then, where he was growing up in Chelsea, which was a real immigrant community outside of Boston. As said in the beginning, you get four Jews together, you get five different opinions.
That's
just what happens. And I remember one of the teachers at the religious school at my synagogue called the area in question that's now, being bombed and, totally destroyed and 30,000 people have killed. She called it a land without people when we Jews were a people without land. Of course, that was a lie. Growing up before the 1967 Six-Day War, what was your impression before the 67 Six-Day War? What did you think about the Israeli state? And had you heard that before, the idea that it was a people without a land and we were a land without, that we were a people without land and there was a land without people?
Yeah, I heard some of that. But I also knew that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians had been, run out of that land, that British colonialism, and what they wanted to, their political machinations,
yes,
was, certainly as important as Zionism. But, it was a journalist, Theodor Herzl, who was kind of the big gun in Zionism. And it was said that he realized that there had to be this safe place when France turned on Captain Dreyfus, that famous case where Captain Dreyfus, a Jewish army officer, was accused unfairly of being a traitor to France and eventually exonerated. It was a very big deal. But the idea that France, considered the most tolerant of nations, would turn on the Jews. Theodor Herzl said, we have to have Israel. Now, I'm not sure that that's not true. I don't really know. But I mean, I do know that it wasn't the first place that they were going to put an Israel was in Uganda.
Something like that. Or Mozambique, yeah. Something like that, yeah.
Right. I mean, this is before Idi Amin. Yeah. I assume that at that time it was one of the European colonies, so that they would have the power to do that, make that happen. But you know, Israel seemed like a distant dream. I personally felt that I had to make, I think the word is Aliyah.
Aliyah, uh-huh.
Yeah, I never felt that I had to go there and that. And I saw it as a kind of, a dreamy place. And the whole kibbutzim, mm-hmm. Idea, you realize I don't even say things properly because I don't know. That was all kind of, wonderful. And utopian in its way, and I it seemed like a good thing. And while I knew that the Palestinians, so many thousands of them, had gone out of the place, I didn't really understand, the depths of the apartheid, the persecution.
Right. Yeah, we're talking about what it means to be a Jew in America these days with the war going on and, what our values have to be, what our responsibilities are. Our guest today is sports writer extraordinaire Robert Lipsight, who has written a former sports and city columnist for the New York Times, talking about what it means to be a Jew. I mentioned World War One and England, and another reference to the First World War. You write, "In some minds, Zionism and British colonialism are simply lumped together as a pragmatic combination that solved the Jewish problems while letting Arabs pick up the bill." End of quote. Today, in the midst of the war, the people of Gaza and the West Bank, the words white colonialism come up again. How are the Israeli state and formerly Great Britain linked in the minds of Arabs, do you think?
Well, I mean, think about the settlers. I guess at some point before, my sensibilities about any of this were educated or even formed, I thought about the words, the settlers. Well, they were the people in Shane who wanted to, the sidebusters, who wanted to make a land out of this great glowing west, and there were the sidebusters, and there were the ranchers, who wanted millions of acres free for their cattle to roam, and so I guess I thought about settlers that way. So if you think about settlers mm-hmm. that way in Israel, then the Palestinians were the Apaches,
uh-huh.
right, and they were dangerous. I mean, maybe there were some good ones, who didn't speak with forked tongue, white men. But they were basically Indians. They, roamed the land, but they didn't really do anything with the land. There were no Indian high rises.
No factories.
Yeah, that's right. There were no Indian factories. That's the point. You could mix up John Wayne and Ben Gurion and Netanyahu and whatever. But the point is that it wasn't really the Wild West. And if it was the Wild West, then we have to rethink
yes.
American colonialism.
Absolutely.
And what we did.
Yes. Yeah, we set quite an example, unfortunately, just taking the land that was there. And you write that everyone, not just Jews, deserves the promise of never again.
And right.
Zionists insist that they're just defending the Israeli state's right to exist. The Zionists often, again and again, cite the horrors of the Holocaust in defense of everything, justify.
Whoa. Stop there before they throw you off the air. You just said the magic word, because And I don't want to be flip or cruel about this, but the idea that the Holocaust is a get-out-of-everything card.
Right.
Can't be true. And it also, it's painful. I mean, talk to an Armenian or a Rwandan.
Right.
I mean, also the idea that there are other peoples who have been, the victims of genocide.
Yes.
And who's not to say that in some way the Palestinians are not now?
Uh-huh.
And who would know that better than the Jews, for God's sake?
I know.
You know, the people of the book, they read the history. The exceptional people who stand as witness before God, if there is one,
mm-hmm.
To the horrors of the earth. That's what we're here for, right? We have to have some purpose.
Yes, I like to think we do, and that we can do good. We can do good. Sometimes humans really do good. They really do. And
and here's where we can do good. Here's where we can turn the whole thing around. You know, I mean, the world is sliding into Trumpism. Actually, Trumpism is sliding into the horrors of the world. I mean, what's the name of your show? What are you about?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Say it again.
Keeping democracy alive.
Keeping democracy alive. And that's what you have to do in Israel. We have to do it in America, of course. We have to do it in Israel. And Israel would be one place to really show, if we started listening to people, if we started creating, you know, some sort of federation, if we started giving Palestinians an opportunity to, you know, to rule themselves. What hope that would be for the world? What hope that's going to be for us, you know, if, you know, this kind of looming monster actually becomes president again.
I know. Well, and I did want to ask about, I mean, one of the things that I think is common to Jews of all different varieties, of which there are many, we believe in justice, equal justice for all. We certainly have.
Well, we have to, Bert. That's the point. I mean, I think that, you know, it just occurs to me when they say people of the book, you know, the book of laws. And the point is that Jews, as much or more than any people, have to believe in justice, have to believe in laws, because otherwise it's the Cossacks coming and cut your heart out.
Good point. We actually have to. And there's an example that you write about your wife, Lois Morris, and the lack of equal justice that you all witnessed. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was kind of amazing.
Do tell.
My wife was a travel writer. In her travel writing period, she went in 1973. It was to do a book for Fromer, on Israel. And of course, you know, that never was published because the war, the 1973 war occurred.
Oh, yeah, that one too.
Yeah. But early in her trip there, an Arab waiter followed her from the hotel dining room up to her room and accosted her at her door. And luckily, her colleague, her traveling partner, you know, was in the next room, heard the yelling, came out, and the two women, beat him off, got rid of him. And then Lois went down to report it. And the manager looked around and said, "Can you point him out?" And Lois said, "Well, he wouldn't still be here." She said, "Oh, yeah, point him out." And she pointed him out. And the woman said, "Great, you don't have to make a statement. We'll take care of everything. From here, you can be sure he's going to be on ice for a couple of months." And my wife was appalled. She said, "Well, wait a minute. Don't you want me to make a police statement? I mean, you know, I mean, I don't think she actually said due process, but that was on her mind." And no, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. Everything's fine. You know, he'll be punished. You can be sure.
Yeah, equal justice.
Equal justice. And you know, it's funny. That's bothered her for the last, you know, 50 years.
I can imagine. And, you know, look at the Israeli jails that are just filled with people who, I don't know, you know, what kind of due process they went to. And the Israeli state says that they're aiming to separate the people of Gaza who want peace from the murderous thugs of Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
Can the same be said of Israelis opposing Netanyahu, do you think?
Aren't you a dangerous man? Listen, don't go there this year. You know, no Jerusalem next year for you. I mean, he's moving into a dictatorship.
Yes.
If they don't arrest him first, you know, we're not hear that before.
Yeah, really.
And I think that, of course, there must be many, you know, I would be a preponderance of Israelis who want peace, you know, who want this, you know, theocratic right-wing government,
right,
you know, replaced. But at the same time, this is a country now under siege. They were attacked in a terrible and cruel way.
Absolutely.
Even if Hamas is representing Palestinians, even if they are freedom fighters, for which a case I'm sure can be made, they still, in this kind of the decency of humanity, had no right to do what they did.
Right.
And Israel had no right to retaliate the way they did.
Right. I agree with you. Well, with the intentional effort to conflate the words Zionist with Jew and to keep it, you know, the same so that the people across the world see what the Israeli state is doing as being for all Jews, do you think what many call genocide being committed by the Israeli forces, has that exacerbated anti-Semitism? What's your feeling about that?
I'm not sure, but your first point about the conflation of Zionism and Jew, that's basically to shut you up.
Yes.
I mean, you know, that's kind of the, you know, the AIPAC way of saying, if you are not 100% for everything Israel has been doing right now, then you don't think that Israel has a right to exist, then you're not really a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
You have no right to be in this conversation. I mean, that's that. I think there's no question that that's the other side of the conflation, because now it's, you know, it's the Jews who are perpetrating. It's not the Zionists, it's not the settlers, it's not the right-wing theocracy that's running Israel. It's the Jews who are maybe making another blood libel. Maybe it's time, you know, to get the protocols of Zion out again and, have another pogrom.
Yeah, it hasn't helped. I don't think it's helped. And in the wake of what you call crazies and thugs vandalizing synagogues, you wrote about that street gang calling itself the Jewish Defense League. You then asked if you were taking your cues from thugs, asking if they were our teachers, in response to that piece of rabbi from your same class at college, whom you mentioned before. There's more to being Jewish than being categorized as such by a hostile world. Do you think that applies to Israeli actions today? Are they falling into the trap that the violent thugs of Hamas laid for them, falling into the trap meeting horrendous violence with even greater horrendous violence? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think that, I think it's Netanyahu and Netanyahu's government that really is pressing this vandalism and thuggishness and this genocide, which I think we're very close to that. At the least a war crime.
Yes.
But that has to stop. I mean, the first thing that has to be, there has to be a ceasefire. It has to stop killing people.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's the first thing. Stop the blood. Staunch the flow.
Yes.
And then start, listening to each other. And I think that, the United States has not been a worthwhile partner in this, vetoing
the UN
issues in the UN. Yeah. So I think it's time we have to step up as well. Like so many people, I hate to criticize Biden because I see the alternative, coming up the road. But, we can't back them 100% like this.
Well, he's been very good domestically and due for criticism on his support, unblinking support for the Israeli state. And I know, I'll just end it with this. For myself, I feel like because I'm a Jew and I believe in equal justice and the law, I don't know if one can be true to the Jewish faith and support what the state of Israel is doing in Gaza and the West Bank at this point. I think this sort of, it's either be true to the Jewish faith or support what Netanyahu is doing here. It's a tough situation for sure.
Well, I mean, it's not too far-fetched to start by saying, I don't think Netanyahu's a real Jew.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in my, invention of Judaism, my imagination of these exceptional people, of these people of justice and law, mm-hmm. of these people of the good book, what he's doing is not, Jewishism, it's anti-Jewishism.
Yes.
And it's a shame that it's engendering more anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
But if you conflate the two, it absolutely makes sense.
It does. Fascinating discussion. Robert Lipside, sports writer extraordinaire, and it's been quite a discussion today. Thank you so much. I don't know if people want to read more of your stuff, if there's anything you can suggest on the internet.
No, I just let them listen to you. This is a wonderful discussion, Bert. I'm so glad you reached out.
Well, thank you very much. And hopefully we can all keep the pressure on and keep democracy alive. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thanks. Keep the faith. Mazel tov.
Mazel tov to you. Hine mahato shevitakem gam yachad shalom. If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Please ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify,
Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.